The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show. On Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Got a great show lined up for you here today. We got lots of things to talk about. We've got Catholics going back to the Mass. We're going to talk to Dr. Edward Shree about that a little bit later. We're going to talk about media misinformation. We're going to talk about embryonic research and some disturbing news there. A lot of great show left for you today, so be sure to stick around all 3 hours. Joining me right now, though, is Wendy Wilmowski. She's been a real estate investor since 1995 and a realtor since 2004. She owns and manages several rental properties, and she's licensed in Maryland and Pennsylvania. She has successfully negotiated millions of dollars in sales of personal homes, investment properties, bank sales, and short sales. She especially enjoys helping first-time home buyers, lots of those these days, and offering advice to baby boomers on how to downsize and transition to the next phase in their lives. Her team, Two Crown Home Team, is with ExecuHome Realty. She's also a graduate of Franciscan University and the John Paul II Institute for Studies in Marriage and Family. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thank you for having me on.
You know, I got to tell you that real estate is the hot topic. I mean, it's all people are talking about these days, how hot the market is, and they're wondering what's the best thing to do in this situation. I live in the Twin Cities. The market is unbelievable here, especially in the suburbs.
Right.
I've heard Texas is hot. I've heard the Carolinas are hot. And we're not just talking weather-wise, Wendy.
No, although this week it is very, very hot. It's everywhere, Ed. It is not just the primary residential market. It is also people buying vacation homes. So areas, you know, I sell primarily in the D.C. area and in Pennsylvania. I hope to get my Delaware license soon. But areas like Deep Creek in Maryland, that homes used to sit on the market for years, are flying off the shelves in a matter of hours with multiple offers. So I think the pandemic has really changed people's mentality, because they're like, okay, if I'm going to be on lockdown, or if something like this were, heaven forbid, it to happen again, I want to be able to be in a nice place where I can work from there, or I can't fly anymore to Europe, so I want a vacation home that's nearby that I can take the family to and get away from the city or our regular life or whatever. So it's a boon across the whole spectrum is what I'm seeing, and it is going from sea to shining sea. I have myself experienced selling something in California, buying something in Delaware, as well as something in Pennsylvania in the last year and a half. And I can attest to all three of those situations personally for me. And then also seeing what's been happening with the buyers and sellers that I'm working with on a regular basis. And in fact, right now I am sitting in a house that is going to go on the market tomorrow. And it is an entry level in the DC area in Maryland. And I fully expect that we will have multiple offers by the weekend. And this for my seller, of course, is a great thing. For the buyers, it continues to be a challenge.
Well, right. And I want to get back to that point in just a minute, because I mean, this is maybe especially for first time buyers, it's especially challenging because they don't have a whole lot of equity to bring into that type of arrangement. But before we go there, let me ask you, you say it's hot across the United States. And I mean, I'm seeing the same thing. I'm reading about this, but is it hot in every single type of area? I mean, are the cities less hot, the suburbs more hot? Is this a function of people trying to migrate out of the high-density population centers? You mentioned the COVID-19 pandemic as being potentially one driving issue here. Is it that type of thing, or are properties in the cities just as hot as properties outside of the cities?
Well, I find that they're hot there because there's just not enough. The biggest thing that's driving all of this right now is a lack of inventory. And in fact, I read somewhere that there's actually more licensed real estate professionals in the country than there are homes for sale. So if you think about that, that's a little crazy. And right. And also, we're at a point right now where, at least in the markets that I deal with, we're starting to see a little bit more trickling of inventory, but we're still at least 14 months out before everything was going to go back to how it was pre-COVID-19. From the data that I've been researching and reports that I've been reading and talking with other agents as well. But certainly I have seen in the vacation market, particularly in Delaware, that there's a lot of buyers coming down from, you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, looking for, lower tax basis homes. You know, they can afford really anything that they want. And it has just torn up the beach market in Delaware and Ocean City, Maryland. I mean, there's just not anything. If something is sitting, it's because it's overpriced. To start with, sellers are, you know, trying to get as much as they can in some cases. But, you know, if it's priced reasonably and it's in decent shape, you know, there's multiple offers and it's going.
Yeah, it's very interesting about this, too. I mean, it's a it's reminiscent in it's actually, I think, surpasses sort of the bubble experience that we had in starting in the late 1990s and extending right up until the 2007 recession. Of course, then we had the crash. And that was fueled by particular government policies and very loose lending.
Exactly.
And that created not just a housing bubble, but of course it created this financial meltdown that crashed in 2008. This seems a little different. This doesn't seem like it's a artificially motivated bubble. This really appears to be genuine demand. And as you said, the genuine lack of resources. So the supply-demand equation here seems to be working, you know, fairly properly.
Exactly. You're exactly right. And the difference, too, is, you know, we've got the stock market that's on fire. So people have a lot of money and, we're still at historic low interest rates. And, you know, people are like, okay, you know, what's going to happen in the future? Interest rates are starting to creep up. They're going to rise up. And they know that if the lower the interest rate, the more house they can buy, right? So
right.
I find that panic a lot with my buyers, that they are like, well, I don't want to wait another year because, you know, what's the interest rate going to be like then? And I won't be able to afford as much or whatever. And, you know, that's a real concern, but you have to weigh that against, okay, but you're in a situation where you're going to be paying, you know, what, 5, 10, 15% over asking price to just win something. So I encourage them to crunch the numbers on, you know, what does that look like at a 3% interest rate versus not having to pay an additional, you know, 5, 10% on top of a, you know, the sales price and paying 4 or 5% interest, you know? So it's, and of course, none of us have a crystal ball. We can't say, okay, yes, in exactly 14 months, everything's going to go back to normal. And, you know, but because people are waiving contingencies and waiving appraisal contingencies and offering well over asking price and paying that difference in cash, and if it even appraises less, they're still paying the difference in cash. It's not at all like what we saw before, because the lending is tight. They're having to prove that they can afford what they're plunking down their money to try and buy.
We are speaking with Wendy Wilmowski of Two Crown Home Team, ExecuHome Realty, and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. If you've got a question about the housing market and the real estate markets right now, give us a call at 888-914-9149. So let's talk about, I mean, this is great for sellers, as you were saying. I mean, people who are selling, people who are looking to either maybe move up or even move down, right? Maybe you talk about baby boomers trying to perhaps downsize a bit or prepare for the longer term. This is a great time to get out of the larger houses. Or for people who are a little younger, who are have expanding families, they need a little bit larger house. This is great because they have a lot more equity at the moment, or a lot more potential equity to make those decisions. First-time
right.
home buyers, however, they're facing a pretty difficult situation right now in the market.
Yes, that's very true. Especially if they're, you know, FHA buyers where they don't have a lot of cash to play. We're, you know, they're getting beat out a lot by cash buyers or people that are using a service like there's a company called Fly Homes that essentially is paying, allowing, giving the cash to the buyer, but the buyer then after they purchase buys the house back with financing from Fly Homes. So, you know, there's some companies that are trying to figure out a way that regular conventional financing people can compete against cash buyers. And that's certainly one potential solution. But yeah, for first-time home buyers, it's been a challenge. I did have a home first-time home buyer, though, recently in the Philadelphia area. I actually was able to negotiate. This was a house listed in the 600,000s. I was able to negotiate under asking price, and they were able to get a home inspection contingency, a financing contingency, and an appraisal contingency. So, you know, it just depends a lot as well on the skill of the realtor that you're working with, but also kind of, in a way, divine providence, you know, like everything lined up to make that happen. I had another buyer in the D.C. area. Everything was that they looked at, they lost out on a home that they offered $65,000 over asking. This was a home in the $700,000 range. And I took them out again. We saw five homes. They said, this one's our favorite, but we know there's going to be a huge bidding war. They went with their second home. And I simply asked the listing agent, is there any reason why you wouldn't entertain my more than list priced offer from my very qualified buyers, who, by the way, were getting financing, if I get you an offer immediately? Instead of like, because a lot of the agents are waiting, you know, they're saying, okay, you know, all offers in by Tuesday at 10 o'clock or whatever. And then you right. know that you're going to be up against a ton of other potential buyers. And she goes, actually, no, I don't think there's any reason at all. So what do? We get them over an offer. They did waive their appraisal contingency and their home inspection contingency, but not their financing contingency. We offered $1,000 over asking. That was it. And they won the house.
That's great.
So yeah. So, there are some bright spots. It's not all, you know, just doom and gloom, but it does take, you know, it's not for the faint of heart, this market, for sure, if you're a buyer.
Not for the faint of heart. And honestly, I mean, it's like so many other things. It's probably not for the do-it-yourselfers at this point, especially if you're a first-time home buyer. I know that there are people who we're speaking with Wendy Wilmoski, who's a real estate professional and obviously wants to help people out as best they can. And it's not quite the same thing as navigating a court appearance on your own, but it's complicated. Buying a house is complicated, and that's the reason why, especially if you're new to it, it's probably a good idea to have a professional help you through those things.
Well, and especially, Ed, because in most markets, in the markets that I work in, there's no downside to have an agent represent you as a buyer, because
right.
they're not paying the commission. The seller is paying the commission. So you might have a transaction fee that you might be responsible for paying, but to have the wealth of knowledge of a professional that has done, you know, hundreds and hundreds of transactions working on your behalf and negotiating for you, that's a no-brainer. You know, and I know there's a lot of people that think, oh, well, I'm just going to get a better deal if I just go in and directly negotiate with the seller, but that seldom works out well, you know,
right.
in my experience.
Wendy Wilmoski is our guest. We're talking about the hot housing market, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Joining us right now is Lizbeth from Las Vegas, Nevada, with a question for Wendy. Lizbeth, welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Thanks for your call.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
I have a question.
Hi.
So I just moved to Las Vegas from Los Angeles. I've literally only been here for about a month. And uh-huh. I needed a new job just because where I was certified back in L.A., my certification isn't working here in Las Vegas. So I'm actually starting to take a real estate class so I could get my license. and I already signed up for it. And I'm just wondering, as you mentioned that there's more real estate agents over homes available, I'm wondering if it's the wrong market to get into at the moment.
Wow, well, that's a great question. And congratulations on your move and starting over. I recently did that as well. In the last 4 years, I got married and moved from Maryland up to Pennsylvania. I still do a lot of business in Maryland. So I'm essentially in your same shoes, you know. I think you have to be smart about what are your skills. If you're a good people person and you are good with technology, or you can hire somebody to help you with that, with your website and getting out in front of people, it's all about networking and networking online and building your base of people that you can then work from to get more referrals and more clients. That's going to be your biggest hurdle, honestly, is getting enough people that will trust you. The other thing that would be a great idea is to research in your area who is a strong realtor that has many years of experience that might be looking to take on a buyer's agent. And you could work with them and learn from them how the market works, how to negotiate, how to work with clients, et cetera. That's always a good possibility as well when you're just starting out, especially in a new market where you may not know a lot of people and not have a good core, sphere of influence, if you will, like you might have had back in California.
Great call. Great question, Elizabeth, and thank you so much for your call. We've got a lot of questions coming in right now, so let's go right to Anne in San Diego, California. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for taking my call. We are selling our house in the next 2 months here in San Diego, and we were wondering is it smarter to rent in the state that we're going to be going into for possibly a year and let things calm down, or should we still buy?
Where is it that you want to buy? Are you moving out of the state, did you say?
Yeah, we're moving out of California, going into Colorado.
Colorado.
Nice.
Wow, Colorado is like screaming hot. It depends where in Colorado, I guess. The Denver area, I know from a good friend of mine who sells there, is unprecedented with how everything is just going through the roof in terms of prices. Largely, sorry to say, because people from California are going over there with lots of extra cash and driving up the prices. It's a tough question if you can even find something to rent. You know, that's a shortage that we have here on the East Coast. But if you could find something to rent and wait it out, you know, it can't go on forever, but none of us knows how long it can go. I mean, there's still this logjam of people that are afraid to sell their houses because they're in the same situation you're in. Like, where do we go? What do we buy? You know, what can we afford, kind of thing. I would get a good agent in Colorado and dip your toe in both and see. You know, see what the rental market is and see. You might get lucky, like a couple of the buyers that I've had work with me, that you might actually be better in the long run when you consider that you're still going to be getting a lower interest rate, that your mortgage might be, you know, equal or less to what you're paying in rent. And then, of course, you know that you're building equity because you currently own a house in California. You know how that works. So that's what I would try if I were you.
And thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Edith in Bakersfield, California. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, so I have a question. So I currently, we just bought a house about 4 years ago, so this is our second house, and we kept our first one. We're renting it out. However, it still has a mortgage, probably another 5 years, and then it'll be paid off. So we have pretty good equity on that rental. Mm-hmm. And a big mortgage on the house that we're in right now. So my question is, you know, because I guess, you know, like everyone else, it gets a little bit scary. It's like, okay, you know, should we buy or sell or what? But my question is, since I have equity on that rental, would it be a good idea to try to borrow and invest on a second rental property? But then that would be, you know, three mortgages that are not paid off. Or is it best just to kind of stay where I'm at since I'm able to, you know, to still make my mortgage payments?
Thank you for calling. Yeah, that one's more of an investment question, Wendy. But I mean, what are you seeing out there with people on that type of setup?
Well, I did exactly what she was saying. At one point, I owned 21 rental units. So I'll just say that, you know, you've got to just see what's best for you in terms of your ability to manage more than one rental unit. It can be a real challenge. You got to then consider not only the mortgage, but then you have, you know, new roof, new HVAC, you know, you've got like all the systems that you have in a house. So I would just advise to make sure that you have enough reserves that you can handle if those kinds of repairs come down the pike and you own, you know, more than two rental properties or whatever. You would have to make that determination yourself if you would be generating enough income from your rents to be able to squirrel away enough money to be able to pay for those things, then it might not be a bad thing to look at.
And we're speaking with Wendy Wilmowski about this very, very hot real estate market. We're going to go one more quick call. It's got to be very quick. Catherine in Medford Lakes, New Jersey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ed. Thanks. I have a quick question. I wonder why, in light of the fact that COVID's winding down and people are returning to work and school, this market is expected to last another 14 months.
Great question, Catherine.
Well, Catherine, it's simply because there's just not enough inventory and there's so many buyers that are out there right now. So you just kind of have to think about, okay, if you have, you know, only, it's like musical chairs, right? So you have 20 people running around five chairs and only one is empty. It just takes a long time for all of that to go through the system, the cycle.
And there's a certain level of buyers that we know about that are out there, and we know what the inventory level is. And so, I mean, you can try kind of extrapolate this in terms of how fast these houses are going to go off the market. Wendy, right. We're just about out of time. Wendy Wilmowski, where can people find out more about you?
Oh, you can go to my website, which is www.twocrownhome.com. That's TWOCROWN. Home, H-O-M-E.com,
twocrownhome.com. And thank you very much for taking time out of what is clearly a very busy work week for you, Wendy. And it's been great talking with you. Wendy Wilmowski, twocrownhome.com. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Robbie Suave about media misinformation filtering and how that impacted a very, very large story. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. What is the role of media outlets in making sure that they get the correct information to you? How much should they try to filter what might be out there regarding whether it's true, false, misinformation, disinformation? That's a tricky question. Here to give us some insight into the failure of media outlets to properly vet information is Robbie Suave. He's a senior editor at Reason.com. He enjoys writing about culture, politics, education policy, criminal justice reform, television, and video games. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, The Daily Beast, U.S. News and World Report, the Orange County Register, one of my favorite newspapers from my youth, and the Detroit News, November 2016. Forbes named him to the 30 Under 30 list in the category of law and policy. In 2017, he became a Novak Fellow at the Fund for American Studies. He also serves on the D.C. Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Robbie, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, if you wrote at the Orange County Register, obviously I have to talk to you, Robbie, because I grew up when that was the Santa Ana Register. Just to let you know, that was I'm a little old, man.
I feel pretty old these days. feel out of touch with youth culture, so I feel you.
Well, I think that that sometimes the culture is out of touch with itself, and this is the issue that we're going to talk about today, which was you get an excellent piece. It was, I believe, on Friday. You posted it over at Reason.com, Reason Magazine, which is a great magazine, libertarian magazine, very intelligent libertarian magazine, always provocative, always thoughtful. And the headline here is, "The Media's Lab Leak Debacle Shows Why Banning Misinformation is a Terrible Idea." And when we talk about the lab leak debacle, we're talking about the origin theories or hypotheses of COVID-19. And one of the early hypotheses was that this was a virus that was being worked on in the laboratory at the Wuhan Institute of Virology in Wuhan, and then it leaked out of the lab. There's competing theory hypotheses to this one. The most embraced of which was the zoonotic transfer, which means it just went from animal to humans, the way some viruses do. SARS did that, MERS did that. But the media seemed to be in a rush and I'm going to use scare quotes here, Robbie, to debunk the lab leak hypothesis. Now, there's actually no evidence, conclusive evidence, in any of these hypotheses as to what actually happened, and the lab leak hypothesis is not debunked, even though the media treated it that way. And this raises lots of questions, right, about the manipulation of public debate.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the media's goal it should be to shed light, to talk about these things. It's fine for them to say, we're citing all these, scientists who think it wasn't a lab leak. I mean, they should know that there are some who do, et cetera. But what really went on for the last year, for the last several months, was anyone who mentioned the lab leak theory credibly was treated like they were insane, like you were like a conspiracy theorist to think that, by the media. You had all these attempts to like silence people from even talking about that. And now those look pretty foolish because, again, we still do not know what happened. We won't know for a long time. We may never know exactly. But there's more a willingness to at least discuss possible other options. So now it looks very foolish to have said that anyone who said that maybe there was something else going on was a conspiracy theorist. And like this had real, implications. Like Facebook was, would take down your posts if you questioned the natural origin theory. And now they're not doing that anymore because they realize there's some legitimate debate over this.
Well, there is a legitimate debate. And part of the issue here is how much of a debate you can have in the public square. This touches on a lot of different things. This touches on, market control that social media platforms have, such as Facebook and Google. It touches on, political correctness and there's partisan issues to this. I don't want to really get into the partisan issues of this because the split on this wasn't entirely partisan to begin with. There are people who have raised this hypothesis a number of times that it doesn't fit into an ideological or a partisan cookie cutter sort of thing, Robbie. And so there's lots of different things to take away from this. Let's just start, though, with social media platforms before we even get into the rest of the media, because the social media platforms are where people, just ordinary folks, right? Not media folks, but just ordinary folks normally would have these types of talks and debates. And sure, people are wrong. I'm occasionally wrong myself. Now, I couldn't point to any particular one time, Robbie, but I'm sure it's happened at some point.
Yeah.
And maybe you have been once or twice as well, but I haven't seen it. So there you go. But obviously I'm joking. People are fallible. They're going to have debates, but that's the reason why you have these debates, is so that people can participate in these, participate in an exchange of ideas, an exchange of evidence, of whatever. It could be anecdotes. to mull over the important topics of the day so as to properly inform them or at least properly prepare them for what comes next. And when you have that sort of interference where they're shutting down those debates on the basis of their own preconceived notions, I mean, that is not healthy for any community.
Yeah, I think it's not healthy. It's a difficult problem, obviously, because when we're talking about social media platforms, we are ultimately talking about private organizations that have broad leeway to set their own policies for what you can say. That, you know, they don't, this isn't the, they act like the public square, but there's no, this isn't, they're not First Amendment bound to allow crazy speech or something. But, you know, I think it's better if they take a broader, a more permissive, you know, hands-off approach, which is generally what they have done. But then you get into, you know, you get into issues with, I mean, there's so much content on these platforms. There are, even you think of like YouTube, there are like millions of hours of new video to watch every like second. So they can't review everything as it's going up. So later, they review things later after there are complaints. So you'll always be able to point to selective input. Well, why is this piece of content up but not this one? You know, blah, 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 blah. It's because, well, that somebody complained about that and they didn't complain about that. So, but with the with this increasing misinformation issue, which really has been a thing that the media has been so concerned about, there has been pressure placed on social media companies to do more to police it, and then they end up doing it in a very biased and very selective way. This is right. This actually has become clear to me in doing a lot of research on this. Is they rely the Facebook. Twitter relies on cues from the mainstream media. They listen to what progressive and mainstream journalists are saying, and they censor based on that. And then you get this reality.
And this is a huge part of the problem. I wanted to start with social media because you're absolutely right about this. I mean, social media platforms are private enterprises. I am a big respecter of private enterprise. I think that we can argue as to whether or not they should have been allowed to conduct acquisitions to get to the size that they're at, but nevertheless, they are private platforms, and people, this is a free association sort of issue. If you don't like the rules, you can go someplace else or go nowhere at all if you want to go nowhere at all. However, of course, you know, that still means that we can criticize those practices and policies. We're speaking with Robbie Swab of Reason.com. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, talking about the media's handling of the lab leak hypothesis of the COVID-19 origin. And I use the term hypothesis very clearly because in science, there's a difference between hypothesis and theory. You know, theory has, in order to get to a theory, you have to have a pretty robust set of proofs that support the idea that this is a serious considered scientific position. Hypothesis is exactly what it claims to be. This is a proposal that the world looks like this in a certain way, and the idea of these hypotheses is to try to gather evidence. That's the scientific basis of this. The media basis of this has not been to try to gather evidence. And to be fair, if you read the Vanity Fair article from this week, the scientific community wasn't all that terribly interested in gathering evidence either. There was a comment, Robbie, about from Dr. Robert Redfield. He was the former CDC director, who said that he actually got death threats from other scientists because he raised the possibility of the lab leak hypothesis being the origin of COVID-19. The only thing I can say to describe this, Robbie, is epistemic closure, I think was the phrase from a few years ago in regards to conservatives and how they were approaching reality. I mean, this is a sort of mirror image of that.
Yeah, and there's this weird idea that this is an idea that Dr. Leanna Wen has pushed, who's a medical expert for CNN, who's often on TV and on Twitter, et cetera, the idea that you can't talk about the lab leak theory because it might spread anti-Asian racism. There's this idea that hate crimes against Asian people are increasing. I think the evidence for that is a little less clear-cut than some people contend. because there are hate crimes that are a difficult categorization, and sometimes right. things are included that shouldn't be, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of it's messy when you look at the data just in general. But when, and others have said, well, yeah, the lab leak theory will spread racism, or make people, I guess, hate Asian people more or something, which I think is very odd because A, it doesn't, if it's the truth, it's the truth, right? If it's right. like our goal is to find out the actual truth of how this thing started. Like the truth cannot be offensive. It's just the truth. But the other thing is, I don't even understand why, like, from the perspective of you're afraid of that you'd get more racism against Asian people, I don't know why the lab leak theory is the one that would spread that kind of animus more aggressively. It seems almost the opposite. Like, if the lab leak theory is true, we're really this whole thing is the fault of like some scientists and the Chinese government. Whereas right. if it's the wet market thing, that has actually more to do with kind of like a Chinese cultural practice. I mean, I don't there should not be any racism or any cultural blaming going on, period. But I would see why you would worry that there would be more animus against Asian people in general if the wet market theory is the origin rather than the lab leak theory. But a lot of people are treating it the other way around.
Well, do you think when you're looking at this, because you've got politicians, you've got some scientists out there that are pushing that idea. You've also got some media outlets that are sort of highlighting the idea that a frank discussion of this issue is going to lead to hate crimes. That's, by the way, that's a more or less a heckler's veto anyway, which is something that we usually strive to avoid in American public discourse. But, I mean, I see that as... And I've seen that for, you know, more than a year as a way to sort of just stop the debate altogether. Is that, well, if you can't discuss this, then you really can't discuss anything about the origins of COVID-19. And it seems like that's more or less the point, is that maybe nobody really wants to talk about the origins of COVID-19.
Yeah, which is, I want to talk about it. I want to understand.
Too.
I've actually even seen that from a lot of people, even some people in the media who are more, much more willing to talk about the lab leak theory. I've heard a lot of people say, like, well, does it actually matter? There's no real policy difference. Like, well, I think it kind of matters. And yes, there should be. I mean, even if it did not emerge from this lab, I would not want to be funded. I mean, we're still kind of getting to the bottom of the extent to which our own government may have funded research at this lab. It may or may not have been this kind of gain of function sort of research that we're now much wary of because of its potential to lead to something like this. You know, there were oversight concerns. Again, none of that is conspiratorial. We don't know for sure the extent of that. We don't know at all that this is what created COVID-19. So there's much more investigating to do. I'm not, you know, getting ahead of anything here, but it's concerning. It's a plausible theory for the origins, and there people were concerned about this research, some of them, and some people were concerned about the oversight at this lab or the lack thereof. So, and like, this matters, right? This was a horrible pandemic. This is the most horrible thing to happen in like human history in the last 50 years. In addition to the tons of lives lost, the disaster on so many other fronts, you know, we've been living this way for a year now. It is important to understand it, and there are policy implications, but it's crazy that for so many of the last months there was there's a moratorium on talking about this because misinformation must be policed.
Right, misinformation must be policed. Moratorium on talking about this. I want to get back to this after the break because I think one of the big blind spots that we had here was performing this through what's called the fact check function in the media. And I think that the fact check function or the fact check industry, Robbie, is probably the biggest loser in this because the fact checkers were out in force trying to shut down the discussion of the lab leak hypothesis. And when we come back from break, we're going to go to break here in just a moment. When we come back from break, we're also going to talk about the fact that while the lab leak hypothesis needs to be discussed, there may not be proof for that either. And we all need to keep an open mind about all the different potential origins of COVID-19, including zoonotic transfer. We're talking with Robbie Swab at Reason.com. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Get a 360-degree look at all the news and issues of the day right now. This is the Drew Mariani Show, getting you connected on Relevant Radio.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're talking with Robbie Swab of Reason.com about media malpractice in dealing with the origin of COVID-19, the debate over the origin of COVID-19, and the resurgence of the, or I guess you can say Robbie, I'm not even sure what you could call this. It's become at least acceptable now to talk about the lab leak hypothesis, if not it being sort of now in the debate, sort of the leading hypothesis. But that's a tricky question too, because we actually really haven't seen solid evidence for that, as well as we haven't really seen solid evidence for zoonotic transfer or other hypotheses as well. And so I think it's important that we make sure that we don't get ahead of ourselves here and start assuming that just because we're discussing it means that that's true. That's how we got in this problem in the first place.
Yeah, that is important. I mean, this is a very, this is a tremendously technical subject. I'm not a doctor. I can't, look at the genetic code for this thing and say, oh, yeah, that was clearly manipulated, or no, that looks like something it might have just arrived out of nature. And you hear from expert commentators, people who are doctors who know this, who seem to have reasonable disagreement. There seem to be
right.
A lot of them saying they think it very well may have emerged from a lab based on what they're looking at. And you have others saying, no, that they're not seeing that. So I don't know how I can't say all we can do. I mean, I think that's the role of sort of people in the media is to say, well, here's what the experts say. Maybe you can say like more experts are saying one way, but you don't want to just like put your thumb on the scale and say, well, this has been decided. One person for this story has decided, I guess, and now nobody can talk about it again. That was really foolish, especially because there's been so much, it's weird to just, I think that's a problem broadly with the like information enforcement. It's so selective. I mean, there has been things that the CDC, that like the government medical experts have said that turned out to be totally wrong, right? They discouraged masks. We're all wiping, and then masks became, no, you have to have a mask. Some people, probably not many of them anymore, but for weeks after the initial wave of the pandemic, people were scrubbing their groceries. They were power washing all surfaces. The gym I exercise in, it scrubs down the gym just a ludicrous number of times per day out of the belief that, that's an important thing you have to do to stop the spread of COVID-19, which we know is not the case at all. That was bad guidance. That this, this spread through breathing, through talking, etc. You're not going to touch your hand on a surface and get it. Like, there's like a one in a million times that's happened or something.
Right.
But we still, we still operate that way because of bad. So does that count as misinformation? When the CDC initially says, don't run out and buy masks. Like, I don't think it. People don't act like it does, but it's not obvious to me why it shouldn't be.
Well, and I think that there's a difference between going through things and not knowing exactly what's what and the what's the word I'm looking for and deliberately shutting down conversations even in the midst of a lack of true information. And that's sort of what the media was doing. Let's reflect now on the fact-checking industry here, which has always been controversial, Robbie. And we're speaking with Robbie Swab from Reason.com, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. The media's fact-checking, I think that there's value in fact-checks when they're done properly. And, Snopes kind of got the ball rolling on this a long time ago, years and years and years ago, maybe 20-something years ago. And even Snopes has been criticized for certain biases in the way that they approach fact-checking, but the media especially has demonstrated a lot of bias. this is, I think, maybe the nadir of the fact-checking industry here is what happened with this lab leak hypothesis. Do you think that this is something that's more or less going to undermine the fact-check impulse among media outlets?
Yeah, I think so. The fact-checking industry has really not has not performed well, I think, in recent history. But there's just a I think there's been a push to start labeling as false things that are more opinion character, where there's like some legitimate disagreement, although the examples don't really come to mind at the minute. But there has been, I mean, like the Washington Post said they chided Tom Cotton for saying, they said he's promoting, when he talked about the idea that maybe it came from a lab, that he was promoting a debunked conspiracy or a conspiracy theory that's already been debunked. That was their headline. Not debunked. It's not a conspiracy theory, really. I mean, not in the negative way we tend to use that. Like, it is sort of a conspiracy type thing if it emerged from a lab and the government, you know, knew that and shut down all conversation of it. But I mean, sometimes governments do things like that are bad. Like, not every crazy thing is untrue. It wouldn't even be that crazy. But yes, the fact check industry, suffers from this problem. I mean, it suffers from a little bit of, I think what you would call like politicization or Trump derangement syndrome, where, you know, and I think Trump did a lot of things that were wrong and he deserved to be called out for them. But there's like not a comparative adjustment in the other direction.
Right. And I think the difference is that you criticize the statements that are wrong or the statements that are demagogic or those sorts of things. But you don't say that just because, you know, some person that you don't like brought it up means that you're not allowed to, that it's outside the discussion of polite company. And that's sort of what happened with this, is it became sort of a talisman for whether or not you were going to take anything that Donald Trump said seriously. And that's really not the question. I mean, just because he discussed it doesn't mean that it's either correct or incorrect. That's a fallacy in and of itself. And the idea is if you discuss it, you get, you can start discussing the evidence or lack thereof for that or any of the other competing hypotheses. One caller, we're not going to be able to get to the caller, but one caller did ask a question: is, can the media be sued about the shutting down of the lab leak theory? And I'm not sure who would have the standing to sue on the basis of that. You have to show that you were personally damaged from that. And people like Tom Cotton are public figures, and so it's well within the bounds of criticism to say, well, even if you're incorrect, to say, well, he's just discussing a debunked conspiracy theory. That's not actionable in terms of a lawsuit. But I do think that it should prompt the readers and the viewers and listeners of those shows to put some pressure on those outlets to A, correct the record, and B, you know, go the out and sin no more, so to speak. Robbie, we've only got about a minute left. I'll let you talk about that.
Yeah, you're right, obviously, about that. Lawsuits against media companies are probably best reserved places where, well, first of all, it's better when the person is sort of is not a public figure, and if they're, you know, they're really unfairly maligned, but there has to be true facts they were accused of, they were, you know, misjudged by the paper, like the, you know, the Covington kids or the right. Or the Rolling Stone, you know, that all that kind of stuff. I mean, those were people who weren't, you know, people until this to them. Generally, just calling out bad stuff that the media does is works better than lawsuits. And then, of course, you can't sue Facebook or Twitter at all. They're really protected from this kind of thing. They have a special additional protection that traditional media companies don't have at all, vis-a-vis 230. So you really can't sue them for kicking you off or taking down something or saying something that was, et cetera.
Well, I think so, Robbie. And again, I think there are good reasons for that. And it's all about having an open debate and the ability to be wrong in public. And that's exactly what was being curtailed here. And it turns out that it may not be wrong in the first place. And so I think it's a great point. You don't want to sue and kill that free speech golden goose. Robbie Suave, Reason.com. By the way, he's also on Twitter at Robbie Suave, RobbySoave. So be sure to follow him there and to keep up with what all the great stuff that he's writing. Coming up next, the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.